I think one of the best statements I ever heard about the Christian life and the way it's often enough lived in the churches came from a man who should be far better known than he is. His name was William Stringfellow. He was kind of the Anglican answer to Dorothy Day, Yale law graduate who right after leaving law school took up an office in Harlem and spent his entire life there working for poor blacks at very little pay. And given the storm that the Anglicans are in today, it might help them to remember that he was homosexual and lived with a homosexual partner until he died, but the man was a saint. And he was here. The chaplaincy at Western brought him here for a week, and he gave a series of lectures, which I was privileged to participate in. And I got to know him a little bit, and he was sort of in an unbuttoned mood one day and said, you know, it always astonished me. I've been going to church for years and years and years and hearing sermon after sermon. And here's sweet Jesus, this nice fellow that everybody, and you couldn't help loving this man. He was so pleasant and nice and wonderful. Then all of a sudden he gets killed. And he remembered, even as a little kid, being astonished. How in blazes do we get from this really sweet fellow, this Martha Stewart of his time, if you will, to this dead body on a cross? The point, of course, is clear. How is it that we represent Jesus in such a way that his cross becomes incomprehensible? Because I think Stringfellow's insight, even though this was now 20, 25 years ago, is still apt. So I'd like to propose that we use Lent as a time to so come to understand the career of Jesus that his crucifixion, instead of seeming like a totally unexpected event, seems to have its own logic in the course of human history. So, we begin, as all 3 years, the cycles of Lent, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, with the temptation story, to see where that can launch us maybe onto this effort to try to make Jesus' death comprehensible. It's funny, I think, to imagine Jesus being tempted, you know, and we, of course, oversimplify radically these texts by saying, oh, Jesus was the Son of God, so this was just something you kind of sloughed off, you know. When Luke uses the word Son of God, and this was written about 85, he did not mean the second person of the Trinity. He just used a normal Jewish idiom, which says that anybody who's faithful to God was a son of God. Moses was a son of God. David was a son of God, sometimes at least. Israel was a son of God. The Son of God does not have some kind of metaphysical significance. It just means if you really are faithful to God, the God of the covenant, then blah, 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 you should be able to do all these things. Tricks. Because the prophets, if you look at the history, I mean, they raised the dead. They did all kinds of extraordinary things, amplified oil for a widow, blah, 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 blah. So this was all coherent with Jewish history. So in what precisely does a temptation lie? To what was Jesus being tempted? And I would also add as a kind of footnote, you don't need to introduce some alien force, the devil, to do this, because I think Jesus, like us, human beings, in all things, as one of the canons of the Mass will have it, except sin, could have this possibility totally by himself. What possibility? Okay. What do we know about Jesus? This was shortly after the baptism, this episode in the desert. Most scholars believe that the moment of baptism for Jesus, as baptized by John, was a moment of clarification. That he came to see the kingdom of God more clearly, and he came to see his own part in the enacting, the effecting of the arrival of the kingdom of God more clearly, too. So Jesus behaved in such a way as any citizen of the kingdom of God would behave, open to everybody. Well, what's all this bread and rocks and jumping off buildings and all that stuff? Well, if you are really convinced that the kingdom of God is of the essence, that one's whole reality is bent toward bringing in the kingdom of God, what better way to do it than with a bunch of religious glitz and bells and whistles and spectacle? You have to remember, Jesus grew up north in Palestine. Most of the families there were very poor, tenant farmers whose land had been expropriated often enough by some of the priests in Jerusalem, as a matter of fact. So they were subsistence farmers, and food was no small thing. And if Jesus could produce all kinds of followers by promising free lunches, why not? Seems like an innocent enough thing. And I've never been to Palestine, but I understand that in the north particularly, there are all kinds of rocks. And if you had that much stuff around, that much raw material, then you were laughing. The problem, of course, is what such a gesture would do to human freedom and capacity to really understand who Jesus was, what he was about, and to alter and transform somebody at their depth. Because if I am drawn to Jesus only because there is the possibility of good meals regularly without payment, that has enormous appeal. But at the cost of my own integrity, freedom, depth, capacity to really understand who I am, and desire to change. Could Jesus have been tempted? Sure, anybody could be tempted that way. We got to get the job done, no matter how. Jump off a tall building, just sort of float down. Like the psalm says, the angels are going to take care of you, and you're not even going to bruise your feet by the time you land. Imagine being able to do that. Boy, oh boy, CNN, the BBC, CBC, ABC, everybody would be there going nuts. And everybody would be going nuts. We got a new celebrity. This is better than Oscar time. But again, what is the point? What is being addressed in us human beings by religious spectacle, so-called religious spectacle? Are we not being defrauded? Are we not being misled? Are not the most superficial levels of our consciousness and self-awareness being addressed and appealed to when that happens? And of course, this is all summarized in this last thing. It shows you all the kingdoms of the world. They're mine, I'll give them all to you. Well, often enough, it does look like they're in the hands of demonic power. Darfur is getting worse, you may know. Iraq is intractable. Palestine is an almost hopeless case. The number of disasters, catastrophes on the planet at this moment is very large. So who's in charge? But Jesus believed that that was a lie. They're not really ultimately in the power of demonic influences. They're in the power of God. So So that's the kind of summary thing about Lent and what happened with Jesus, I think, over and over and over in his life, confronted with the possibility of some kind of dishonest short-circuiting of the process of trying to relate to people or to con people, to bribe, to counterfeit religion, therefore. So, the temptation, I'm sure, was there for Jesus. If it is true that he was human, like us in everything. How many times have I walked into a classroom or met somebody wanting to put my best foot forward, put the best face on things, draw into my circle a crowd of adoring students, although anybody who's taught knows that that doesn't happen all that easily. But that doesn't keep me from wanting it or trying it. But at what cost? So Jesus' integrity was at stake here. Just as our integrity is at stake here. And so the Sundays of Lent will give us time to say, where is that integrity at risk? And then, not surprisingly, to want to outgrow those impulses to cheat, to defraud, may well be painful.